Welcome everybody to our 10:30 a.m. November 12th Blue Ridge Juvenile Detention Commission meeting. I'm going to call us to order, and Kathy, first thing is matters from the public. Is there, can the public access these meetings, and do we have any?
They can, and I don't see anybody in our waiting room. So if somebody arrives after we pass this part, I will just admit them. So if you see somebody else pop up, that will be why, but nobody as of right yet.
Very good. And then I'll move on to the meeting minutes from September 10th, 2020. Those did go out via email to all of us. And if you've had a chance to review them, I would entertain a motion to approve them.
So moved. Second.
Okay, I have a motion and a second. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 And those opposed, like sign. Okay, we have approved minutes from September 10th. Under old business, there was a second agenda sent out following the first one. Eric had mentioned putting on this old business discussion about local CARES funding. Eric, I don't know if you want to maybe lead that, or Kathy, one of you, but Kathy, go ahead.
It came up at the last meeting. Would there be a way to give some CARES Act money before the end of December from the localities that have that to give? And I think that one of the things I was going to do between that meeting and now was give an idea of about how much we've spent on COVID-related items since the beginning of this fiscal year. Because the grant that I applied for really only accounted for anything that had been purchased up through June anyway, because the grant was due, the application was due at the end of June. So there were a couple items in the grant that I tried to forecast through next year, because the grant goes through next year. But most of that is related to some of the like single use items for the kitchen, like the paper and the plastic and that sort of thing. So for the most part, everything that was, you know, asked for in the grant has already been purchased before July, for the most part. What we have spent since the beginning of July is roughly, on Great Plains, on our financials you'll see for September, it's roughly about 12,000. In our accounting, it's roughly about 14. So I just don't think everything is accounted for in Great Plains quite yet. So the roughly 14 is accounted for in our financials. And I guess what I was hoping to gain today was some clarity about which localities actually have CARES funding to contribute, and how do we need to break that out since it's already accounted for in our financials for the first quarter.
And Kathy, before we even get into to that part of it, some of you may know better than I do, but there's some, obviously some extensive federal guidance on these CARES funds. And I know at least in some instances we've run up against that guidance saying that the funds have to be spent within the boundaries of your own locality. I don't know how that works with a regional commission. It may be perfectly okay, but I don't know if anybody's talked to their auditor or thought about whether or not we can indeed do this, even if we have it to do.
Well, since the facility is actually in Albemarle County, I'll call that and raise you one. I think that we would certainly entertain the opportunity, but we would have to evaluate on a specific example, right? With, so it's very fact specific from a compliance standpoint. So I can't speak for others who do not host this facility, but Albemarle County would have to consider whether it's compliant or not. We're at a point now where our compliance team is winding down, because we have made all of our judgments and expended what money we think that we can within the time frames. But We're also going to be doing some supplanting, we believe, and having then some funds, some general government funds available to continue support after the first of the calendar year when the CARES funding is not specifically available. But all that is to say is that we would need to respond to a specific request to determine whether in fact it is compliant or not.
Yeah, I mean, from Fluvano's point, I mean, if there are indeed, you know, direct COVID related expenses that we could offset, I mean, we do have the funding at this point, and we could allocate the funding depending on what it is from, you know, the Fluvana share. And, you know, as I said before, that just kind of offsets what we're having to pay from a locality out of our general fund. So to me, that makes sense to do that if we can do that. And I don't know, like I said, you said it's either 12 or 14,000. Is that current or is that what you're projecting through the end of the end of this calendar year, Kathy?
That's current. That is through September. And we've had, you know, like less than $1,000 of other purchases since then for October, November that have been separated out. But as of right now, what is showing in Great Plains is about 12,000. So some things don't appear to have hit quite yet. And, you know, there's some things that I'm exploring, like UV lighting for our air handlers, but that has to go through the procurement process. It's estimated to be about $10,000, but that is not going to happen by December. And I know that everything has to be it has to have been purchased and done by December, I think, for you guys to be able to contribute to that. So basically right now, since July, we've spent about 14,000. That we were easily able to break out as specifically because of this pandemic. So, and I don't know where Charlottesville stands, and then Letitia can't be here today, so I'm not sure. I guess obviously I would need some guidance from Jeff Brill about how to break that out for the localities that would want to do that, and I guess bill you guys for it.
Yes, and we have no idea from a compliance standpoint how that would work, and we're not going to be able to determine that in today's meeting. I don't believe we Albemarle County would have to respond to a specific proposal. I don't know here that the juice is worth the squeeze. I think you understand when I say that is that how much do we put into trying to figure out how five jurisdictions contribute CARES money or supplanted CARES general fund support to overcome, you know, $12,000 to $14,000 worth of costs when year over year you do tend to have a significant positive variance, including this year. So I'm just not sure that it's going to be worth how much is going to have to go in to figure out what we can do legally.
I guess that's kind of where I am with Doug, is that we've, you know, got a spending plan for our CARES money. I'm sure we're going to bump up against the end of the year, and I could easily pull out, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 and send it, but we'd have to have the specific request, the documentation of the expenses and et cetera, and I'd have to make sure the auditors are square with it, and I just don't know if it's worth the effort. If it was a lot more money, I'd say yes, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I know you. This is a weird word to hear coming out of the mouth of Albemarle County, but we've been far more conservative in our determinations of eligibility than we have seen play out around the state. I can't speak for any of you. But that would have to be a factor too, is that, you know, all of us would have to agree that would think to some extent that it is, that it meets the eligibility requirements. So all you liberal CARES people around the region, I don't know. I mean,
you know, if it was more substantial from a dollar standpoint, I would certainly want to look into it. But if we're only talking 12,000,
through October. Through October, it's $17,090.
That seems off from what we've got just in our own.
Well, October record, says October shows 4,986 hitting in 33205 account for materials and supplies COVID.
Okay, so we'll have to get together because that's not what it's looking like on our end. So I need to look into what that is because I don't recall making any purchases that would add up to that much.
It's some
Virginia. So I don't know, you know, if it's in the wrong, it was placed in the wrong.
Well, the big portion of it is one invoice, Virginia Institute of the Blind.
Gloves.
So they usually do our gloves. So if we got another order of gloves that hadn't been accounted for in my review, then that was probably it.
That hit in October.
Okay.
$4,300 some dollars.
Yeah, they're expensive. We get a lot. So there you go. There's another purchase that is much higher than it used to be because of the pandemic.
Right.
Well, like I said, I just wanted to bring it up. We had discussed it last time. If it's going to be a process, and you know, we have to get all the jurisdictions to determine if it's CARES eligible or not. That just seems like it's not a path we want to go down. Then,
is that kind of the consensus here? Or I don't want to dismiss it, but
that's mine.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I appreciate talking about it. I think it was worth the discussion. Let's move on to new business and start with the fiscal year 20 year-end audited financial report, which is good news.
Yeah. Let me grab that. So after the auditors came in and proofed the trial balance and gave us a clean slate, the net income is $407,483 for FY 20 year end, and that is audited once again. So at that, we have calculated the distributions that would be to the localities for the $407,483, and Albemarle share would be $92,499, City of Charlottesville, $144,249, Culpeper, $98,203, Fluvanna, $33,006, and Greene County, $39,526. So I've got the, if it's get authorization, I got the check request ready to take to the county to pay up if approved by the board, unless they wanted to keep the funds somewhere else.
Thank you. I think we talked about this some previously and wanted to wait until obviously it was an audited number, which it now is. So, you know, I'm welcome to any discussion, but I would also entertain a motion to go ahead and proceed with cutting those checks and returning those funds to the counties.
I'm ready to make that motion.
Yeah. So a motion from Doug, is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Eric. All those in favor, sorry. All those in favor, raise your hand, say aye.
Mm-hmm. Aye.
Okay, any opposed? Hearing none, we'll go ahead and proceed with that. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could ask Jeff Brill, I assume that is the audit document complete, and can you send that out to the commission if and when it is?
You mean as far as the CAFRA?
Yeah.
I haven't got it yet.
When are they telling you you're going to get it?
I have not heard from the auditors of when they're producing it. I can send him an email and see when he'll have a final, but like I said, he just sent me a final trial balance and he agreed to that.
Okay. Fair enough.
That's what I usually wait on is a final trial balance to say, hey, do you agree with everything?
Understood. Okay. But you're going to send that out to the commission.
Yeah, but they usually, if I remember correctly, that usually doesn't come until they do production. It comes in like January.
All right. Okay.
Okay. And then we have an unaudited financial report through September 2020. Jeff?
Yeah, hold a second. Marcy's coming. Hey, Marcy, I'm in the board meeting with Blue Ridge right now. Thanks. Sorry about that.
You put Marcia on the you put her in the meeting.
She's probably got a question about our other meeting.
Yeah, she probably does.
Yeah, okay. So we were going to look at September year to date. It's still early in the year.
Before we start, if everybody could look at their financials, there was an error that was discovered about an hour ago. So if you look at page 3, column J, line 81, it looks like maybe somebody's finger got stuck on the 3 button. That whole number should not be there at all. So that changes the bottom of column J, line 95 should say 159. And line 97 should say 259,250. Which then on page 4 results in line 131 of column J being 150,594. It didn't affect any of the other bottom line numbers, but I wanted to point that out. And I can send out the corrected one if you'd like.
If you would do that, that'd be great.
Okay, I will do that.
Yep.
Okay, sorry, Jeff, go ahead.
That's okay. And it would have been my finger, just so you know. We just didn't catch it before, but the extrapolation is where we estimate we're going to come out. So that doesn't change that number because that was in a year-to-date number, not our extrapolation number. So that being said, so right now, back to the report, total compensation, even where we're just 3 months in, it's estimated would come in under budget around 293. Salaries are estimated to come in under budget 285 due to vacancy savings right now. And overtime and holiday pay is over budget 63 because of a Kronos issue with the time card system that we've been working on. But the majority of that amount is actually holiday pay, as our overtime wages during the first quarter is less than 1,000. So it's really just a holiday pay issue with Kronos and how it's coded. We anticipate being able to accurately reflect this holiday pay and its own category pretty soon. And the FICA and VRS are estimated to come in under budget $14,000 and $27,000, basically because the wages is under. Health insurance is estimated to come under $30,000 as well. Total expenditures, right now we think it's going to be on budget. It's still too early to tell how every line item is going to come in. Hopefully we'll have a better judge by December or so. And revenues is estimated to come in under budget about $58,000. And interest income is about $19,000 of that. Interest income has really dropped off for all localities at this point. And so total net income is estimated to come in over budget around $234,000 at this time, but it's still only 3 months into the year. So we'll have a better judge as we go out through the year better.
Questions?
What are the vacancies right now?
We have 3 vacancies for resident advisors that are being filled at the end of this month. And then we still have the 2 frozen resident advisor positions. And right now, our clinician put in his resignation several weeks ago and is gone, and we're in the hiring process, the interview process for that position right now.
Any other questions for Jeff or Kathy? Kathy, remind me, do we need a motion to accept this report or?
Not really. I mean, it's not, you can accept it. I can't remember how we've been doing it. I don't remember if y'all accept every meeting we have through up through September. It doesn't hurt if you accept it.
We typically don't. It's not, there's no.
I don't remember us doing it before, but.
We'll move on then.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, still under new business, is hazard pay, second quarter FY21.
So, as you'll recall, last meeting, the commission approved hazard pay for the months of July, August, and September. Staff, of course, were very grateful for that. So thank you once again. What I'm proposing today is that we continue with that for the months of September, or October, November, December, at the same amount. So it would total less than $20,000. And between the last time we did this and this time, as you know, I informed everybody that we had a staff who tested positive, and it was quite the stressor for people to know that. Thankfully, it appeared that it was an isolated case. The health department didn't feel we needed to do facility-wide testing at that point because there was no evidence that the staff member had contracted it here. And several people actually were tested on their own accord for peace of mind and came back negative. So that was encouraging, and it helped, I think, illustrate that the protocols and practices that we have in place right now hopefully are helping not have something like that spread if it's in our building. So it's been, just like for everybody else, a long 8 months, stressful for everybody. And I think that this extra pay goes a long way, and I'm requesting that we approve it through this second quarter.
Mr. Chair,
questions? Here.
Is there, I mean, obviously COVID doesn't seem like it's magically going away. So what is the thought for this going forward?
I mean, I think that if we stay on the track that we look like we're on now, our vacancy savings would cover it for, you know, the first quarter of 2021. But obviously I want to, you know, ask at the end of each quarter for the next quarter or for the previous quarter in case something changes. So my plan would be, if things don't die down a little bit between now and then, that I would probably request it again. I think it's hard to predict, obviously, where we'll be by our next meeting, but you know, I think the jail, it's my understanding that they're going through December, so I know that this might not be something that can, you know, just be open-ended forever, but I do think it's helped with maintaining the staff that we have maintained.
Yeah, for the Mr. Chair, for the non-ACRJ board members here, the jail board did authorize the additional hazard pay through December. I do think though that it's context of that now is this rather uncertain language that has been with regard to an appropriation for state support for bonuses for certain employees, state supported constitutional officers, regional jails, I guess DJJ, but not DJJ, not regional juvenile detention center employees. And so there is a bit of a concern that I have in trying to be somewhat equitable in recognizing the hazards for a juvenile detention center are similar to a hazard for a jail facility, that it looks like that the that regional jail corrections officers will receive a $500 bonus but employees of the juvenile detention center will not. That's my best understanding. I know that Jeff Brill and others and Jeff Gore have been looking into that. I say that because I think it matters in thinking about what's going to happen in the future. For example, I don't expect that the regional jail, if they get the $500 bonus, will be asking the jail board to extend their hazard pay beyond January 1st. I don't know that for sure, but based on what I've heard Superintendent Coomer say, I don't think that he will. And part of that is because they're getting a $500 bonus also. And if that's not the case for the Juvenile Detention Center, then I would be inclined to want to at least entertain Kathy's recommendation, assuming that we don't have a vaccine next month for that first quarter of 2021. So let me stop there and see if that's prompted anything. I did want to bring this up and talk about both the hazard pay, which I will support wanting to extend for the rest of calendar 2020, and this somewhat mysterious appropriation of state funds that hopefully somebody else can speak to more clearly.
And also, Doug, to add to what you were saying, I had reached out to my colleagues after your email regarding that information and discovered there was an item 477, number 4C for central appropriations that speaks to, contingent upon the funds being available, of course, that $15,543,843 from the general fund. The second year is provided for a one-time bonus equal to 1.5% of their base salary on September 1st, 2021. So a year from now, depending on whether it's even available by then. And that does include detention specifically in their language. But for right now, for my request today and possibly for the first quarter of 2021, I think it would be, that's where I would be at.
Okay.
But I wanted to make sure everybody's aware that there.
No, thank you. Because it's been hard to decipher.
Yeah. And I also think with this language, when we develop the budget for FY22, obviously I want to take these numbers into account too. So.
Yeah. Can I add a comment?
Yes, sir.
I said I had spoke to the compensation board, to the SACO. Let's see. I had sent her an email and said, okay, the jails qualify for the 500. Where does that leave the detention centers? So she had sent me language saying that they were not part of it at this point, that she didn't think they were part of it.
No.
Typically, when a state supported local employee pay raises or bonuses as is presented on 9/1 is included in the budget. There is also a line item for those employees that reads as follows: full-time employees, community service board centers, living detention centers supported by juvenile block grants, juvenile delinquency prevention, and local court services units, local and service boards, act and comprehensive community, corrections of employees and local departments where a memorandum of understanding exists with the Virginia Department of Health. In the case of the $500 bonus on 12-1 designated for law enforcement entities, I've posted below the full language of the budget amendment, and at this point she does not feel it includes the detention center as the way it's written in the language, and she provided all kinds of paragraphs and things to refer back to, but her opinion was they were not included.
Mr. Chair, Jeff Gore, are you hearing anything from your other clients about this?
No, just talking with Kathy, exchanging emails with Kathy about it. But I read the budget language the same way that Kathy and Jeff Brill do. And that is the money, the $500 bonus, that does cover jail employees. Yeah. Does not have the language.
Those that are comp board supported. Right.
Does not cover Juvenile Detention Commission employees. That's the contingent language. So that's a different budget provision that is entirely contingent on enough funding being there at the end of FY21. If it is, then the budget item gives the governor, directs the governor to appropriate $97 million for various raises, one being, not raises, bonuses, one being 1.5%, not a $500 bonus, but a 1.5% one-time bonus in FY22, which would cover the juvenile employees. So I think on that one, you know, it's not till FY22. We won't know till the very end of FY21. So I think that's just a wait and see. Now, there's always a chance, depending on the budget outlook and the revised revenue forecast that the state will do heading into the 21 General Assembly session, there's always a chance they can revisit this language and not make and remove the contingency if things look better. So I think, you know, I don't think there's anything that we can act on today. Just know that it's out there. You know, hopefully the state revenues look better in January and they can take the contingency away and we'll know that this money's coming. Or maybe they'll, optimistic enough, they'll change it to a raise and not just a bonus. But for now, nothing in the recent budget action for juvenile detention employees.
Okay.
I don't think the block grant was affected either, Kat. So the block grant was not reduced, which is good news.
Right.
Well, I appreciate that further explanation. I think for the purposes of the item that's on our agenda today, just to acknowledge that it looks like that all of our jail employees, regardless of what jail that you are a member of, will be receiving a $500 bonus if your comp board supported, and our juvenile detention employees will not.
And I believe DJJ is included in that as well. And obviously we take DJJ's kids and we always have their kids before they do. So
yeah, so I'm using that to further support my interest in trying to, for the next 3 month period, support the hazard duty pay.
Thank you.
Well, I support, you know, based on the conversation, I certainly support it as well, and I support the quarter at a time approach that Kathy's taken. So, Doug, I don't know if you want to make that in the form of a motion.
I'm certainly glad to do that, Mr. Chair. That's a motion.
Do I have a second? Not hearing a second.
Sorry, second.
Thanks, Eric. All those in favor, please signify by waving or saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, so the $1 per hour bonuses or hazard pay will continue on for October, November, and December, Kathy, and then we'll talk about January, February, March at a future meeting.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I know our staff will be very pleased. Appreciate it, you guys.
Well deserved.
Yes, well deserved.
Matters from the director.
Okay, so we talked about the grant. I'm still continuing to try to finish the process of accepting the award because of GMIS issues and having to have the finance director involved in that. And so the moving parts aren't moving as quickly as I like, but we're making progress. And I've already spoken with somebody at DCJS to say, hey, I couldn't put in the first report because I still haven't been able to even accept the award. They assured me I'll be fine. The CARES we've talked about, talked about our staff positive COVID test. I think we've bounced back from that. We've continued to have scares here and there, but take them all one at a time and do the best we can to keep everybody safe. I know the last time we talked at the end of the meeting, Letitia had shared with me what CAT is doing for staff testing. And I spoke with the director of CAT, and they have many more employees than we do. So the scale of what they're doing would be beyond what we need. And MedExpress, I spoke with them, and they need a minimum of 40 to come on site, which we wouldn't have in just one single day anyway. So right now I'm in the process of talking with LabCorp because our nurse practitioner, who actually is employed full-time at the jail, is able to order some tests from LabCorp. They drop them off. she and her staff do the swab. It's the swab and not the way up in the brain thing. I know it doesn't really go in your brain, but that's what it feels like in here. And they, LabCorp picks them up, processes them. It's $100, I think, per test. So they're doing that with their inmates, from what I understand, in order to be assured when they put them in general population that they've been quarantined and they've been tested at the beginning, tested at the end. So it's provided a lot of reassurance in decision-making, I think. And that would be something that I would be more interested in at this point, because it sounds like LabCorp can send them as I need them, and I don't have to set up a certain day or 3 days a week for them to set up in the parking lot and staff come in and that sort of thing. So I'm not really talking about staff testing yet, but I also think that if this works out with LabCorp, it can be in a way that is, I get them as I need them. And I would add staff to that. If we were to have like another positive test here, you know, my understanding from the health department is, depending on how far apart positive tests are with staff or residents, I think an outbreak is considered two or more. So at that point, I feel like we might even be able to get LabCorp to drop us off enough tests, have our nurse do them, send them off, get them back. So I'm in the process with LabCorp in trying to nail that down. we talked about our vacancies, and that's about it. I think that's all I was going to fill you guys in on. And we covered it pretty much in all the other parts of the meeting. The only other thing, well, actually, Jeff, maybe when it's your turn, you can bring it up about the education piece, the Youth Commission on Youth. You know, there's a lot of movement to try to decrease the number of teachers in detention centers right now because the population is low. But I think some of the driving force behind that is from, you know, people who've been around for a long time, and detention was a lot different than it is 30 years ago than it is now, in terms of, you know, the level of need of our kids and the quality of education that we provide them. So I'll let Jeff speak more to that, if you're okay with that, Jeff. I think that's
Before we move off of COVID, I want to make a comment. As we, you know, as we kind of migrate now towards, well, we're not migrating really, there will be a vaccine. And there already then is conversations occurring about the employer-employee relationship with respect to mandatory vaccines, particularly for safety-sensitive positions. Mm-hmm. And so we've begun that work here at the county, working with our HR, our infectious control professionals, and our county attorney's office. And so I bring it up because I think that all employers in safety-sensitive work are really going to be faced with, you know, some variety of the same question. And so I'm saying this with Jeff Gore on the line, because he's obviously has a lot of other clients who might have the same questions. But it is this question about the extent to which that you can require someone to take a vaccine, or otherwise mitigate if in fact you can't require their exposure for the health of themselves and the health of other people. And then philosophically, really, is should we require, right? So I'm just throwing it out there, not to discuss today, but just to put a pin in it, because we're trying to stay in front of these issues, and this one's going to be coming.
Yeah.
That's a good point, Doug. Any questions or discussion regarding Kathy's report? Hearing none, I'll move on to all of you. I do not have anything myself, but is there any matters from the other commissioners?
Did Kathy want Jeff to speak to something specifically? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I think we're going to go to that next under matters from the attorney.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about Jeff, brother. Too many Jeffs in the world. I can't keep it straight. Yeah, I did have a matter, Mr. Chair. And I did not discuss it in advance with Kathy, and I'm sorry about that. But really, it's just also a kind of a for awareness. The jail board, in just about an hour or so, is going to be receiving a report of the assessment of the jail providing its own internal support services, right? So finance, HR, IT. And moving away from the County of Albemarle as a fiscal agent. I think I've mentioned this before. There's no action today on that, but there is going to be a recommendation by the staff that action be considered in January. And the juvenile detention facility center and the jail are pretty closely tied together in some ways. And so I just didn't want to miss an opportunity to kind of to inform the commission that this is happening, and then to ask Kathy. And I know I'm putting you on the spot, and I'm sorry about that. To kind of how this relates to where you think that the detention center is going to be going. So I'll probably muddle that enough, but you can kind of clean it up for me.
No. I know before COVID hit, we were wrapping up our part in that study or assessment. And I believe we were just awaiting the final report. COVID hit and everything just kind of fell to the wayside. So I honestly can't remember if we actually got the final report. I don't think we did. So I need to, check in with her, but I also know she's now by the county, right?
Yeah, it's a little awkward. And she definitely finished the jail report, and that's what's being presented today. And right. And she, is kind of wearing two hats today, right? As the former consultant and now the CFO for the county. So
even though we don't have our final report, or if we do, we never even had a discussion about it, because my plan was to have her present to you guys about it rather than me, since she's the expert in that. So there's that part of it. Then the other part of it is that, when we first started talking about this, Martin and I talked too about what they're doing, what we're doing, what it would look like to share some things, because as you know, we shared Jeff, and we share IT with the jail. When it comes to, the amount of employees that would be needed, the space to house them, what their responsibilities would be for us, vice versa, it seemed like at the time I was more in favor of staying with the county and trying to get clarity about where the county's at with what they feel like they're providing us, and whether they're providing it at the right cost. Is it too high? Is it too low? That sort of thing. So I think we were still in that area of exploring this issue, where it sounds like the jail continued to move forward with their process. And it's just fallen off my radar, to be honest.
Okay. Just because it's coming up today and with a recommendation, and then potential action in January for implementation with the new fiscal year in July, just want to make sure that everybody's aware that there could be some changes.
Okay.
Thanks for bringing that up, Doug. That definitely should be an ongoing agenda item for our future meetings. Mm-hmm. Any other questions, comments, items from commission members? Hearing none, Mr. Gore, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, just on Doug, on your point about the vaccine, that's interesting. I haven't even been looking at that yet. I guess the vaccine's been so theoretical, I didn't want to hold out too much hope for it, but now that it's starting to potentially become a reality, I think we do need to as employers, as public bodies, particularly in public safety areas, need to start thinking about what can we do as far as requiring or not the vaccination. Thanks for raising that. We have our Thursday firm call at 2:30 or WebEx call, and I'll bring that back and to them and get the rest of the firm to start thinking about it. Regarding the Kathy mentioned funding for education. So the Virginia Commission on Youth has been looking this summer and fall at how education is funded for local and regional juvenile commissions, detention centers. And I sent Kathy, and you can circulate it if you want to the group, Kathy, but a link to this report. It's very brief. It's just a couple pages, but it's got 11 recommendations. And they're all are pretty much, half of them are geared towards reducing the funding or adjusting the funding. And I think, you know, it's an acknowledgement on some level of the reduced population trend in juvenile centers, but I'm not sure it fully accounts for, you know, all the state kids that are in a lot of these facilities like Blue Ridge, or the unique challenges that are faced in educating children in this setting. So I don't have a lot of information on it other than this very general report that is really focused on sort of updating the funding formulas to reflect the current practices and current needs, with an eye towards reducing the expenditures. It raised some red flags for me. You know, whenever I'm talking about reducing state funding that goes to juvenile centers for education, I'm concerned. So there is a public comment period that is running through December 2nd. So Kathy, I'm assuming your colleagues and your association is going to be looking at this.
Yeah, the last I had talked with our group about it, I believe BJDA was going to take a position and submit something in writing regarding that. And basically, I believe everybody's on the same page about the position of not supporting that. Some of the ideas that were floated around were, you know, essentially kind of having like substitute teachers, part-time teachers come in and out. And, you know, maybe we don't need to do SOL testing. Yeah. Maybe we don't need to have art or, you know, phys ed on, and all of those things that, you know, basically just continue to contribute to our kids not being successful. So it actually gets me really irritated, but I think we're all on the same page with that. I don't think it's hard to describe to people what goes on here and how important it is for our kids to be in small classes. And you know, I know our population is low, but this is a whole different ball of wax that we've got going on here. And, you know, when a teacher can have a student who's 10 years old and in, like, you know, the fourth grade, I think you're 10 when you're in fourth grade, I don't remember, but, and a high school student working on chemistry, and it's like Little House on the Prairie, but in a really intense environment. So, it's a challenge, you know, and to just kind of look at that as more of a, how can we be more efficient and maybe have one teacher teach three different subjects? I don't think that's suitable for this environment. And so, yes, our group has been talking about it, and, you know, that date is approaching quickly. So I for one want to make sure that we submit something.
And there may be some of the recommendations, like one of them makes sense to me, and that is to you know, ensure a seamless re-enrollment in the local school division, I guess, you know, outside of the facility once the child's, you know, back in. You know,
logical, reasonable ones we're in support of.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm just saying when your association puts together, I would address all 11 recommendations and there's some you support, I would indicate that. But I mean, one of these is really disturbing to me, and I'm not sure what it's getting at, but it's clarify that the requirement that juveniles and residents who are in custody of state operated programs shall be provided education and training that is at least comparable to that provided in the public school system. They can't be saying what it sounds like they mean, and that's like echoes of like separate but equal kind of a discriminatory education system. So I don't know where this is all coming from. You know, it needs to be equal to what is being provided, in the regular school system, because that's what the kids have are entitled to, and that's what the state has a constitutional requirement to provide. It doesn't change in my mind because they're in this setting. So if that's some sort of, you know, philosophical justification for reducing funding, that we need to push back on that.
Yeah, I don't know for sure. I think that that language may have had something to do with, somebody pointing out that, well, in the public school, you could have 25 or 30 kids in a classroom. So how can you justify having only 5 in a classroom here? And again, I would point out that very different environment, very different level of needs. Very often, those kids that were in the 25 and 30 child classrooms have already been expelled or kicked out of that classroom or expelled from the school system. So we're talking a whole different situation. So I think our kids are some of our most vulnerable and may become even more vulnerable when it comes to education if some of these items move forward.
Right. So we're keeping an eye on this, and if there's more information, we'll get it, either Kathy or I can get it out to you all. It sounds like if there eventually there are final recommendations of the Youth Commission, there probably will be legislation and budget amendments in the 21 session to implement some of this. So we'll keep monitoring.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. Anything else from your end?
You all read the endless special session of the General Assembly is finally over. And it's going to roll right. We're going to turn around, and we're going to be in the regular session in 21. So that's it. But it was very strange. It was all done electronically. There was no opportunity to meet directly to advocate, directly with legislators. They're going to continue to meet, when they convene, the House and Senate are going to, it sounds like they're going to keep doing it in the Science Museum and the Siegel Center or somewhere else in Richmond for the House of Delegates. And if they, in the committee meetings won't allow public physical presence, even if they do convene physically together. So the 21 session is going to be a lot like the special session, just so you know, it's for your localities, for your local agendas, if you have legislative agendas. It's going to be very, difficult to have, the normal input. So I would just emphasize, talking to legislators in advance of the session is very important, probably more than ever this year, if you have priorities. And to connect with them directly. You can't rely on going to the General Assembly and being in a committee meeting and talking to them there or presenting physically in front of a committee. So that's going to continue. So it's hopefully this will be the last session it's like that, but it's I think it was very awkward, and that will continue is what I'm hearing. So just keep that in mind.
Good advice. Thanks, Jeff.
Yep.
Okay, anything else for the good of the order from the group? If not, I guess we are adjourned. Thank you all, and I hope everybody's doing okay. Yes, sir, Doug.
Nope, I'm just waving goodbye. Thanking you, Mr. Chair, and everybody else waving goodbye. So,
all right,
Happy Thanksgiving, Merry Christmas.
Right,
all the things.
Same to you, Kathy.
All right,
thanks all.
See you guys.
Hi, happy Thanksgiving. Bye.
Take care.